it's a positive thing that we're all in the field now.
Governor Walker was on hand at the White House today for a federal disaster declaration on opioids. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 26th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, the nightmare saga of an abandoned fish processor continues near Unalaska.
Captain's Bay in the wintertime can be absolutely crazy with winds, and we've seen it time and time again where anchorages don't hold.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play.
Today, President Donald Trump took a major step in dealing with the opioid epidemic, killing tens of thousands of Americans a year.
I am directing all executive agencies to use every appropriate emergency authority to fight the opioid crisis.
The White House speech laid out an ambitious vision of stamping out opioid addiction within a generation while treating those currently suffering. Trump mentioned his own brother's struggle with alcoholism and of being moved by infants born at a hospital in West Virginia dependent on opioids. But the speech offered few concrete policy proposals to aid public health officials, families, and first responders across the country. Alaska's Bill Walker was among six governors who were at the White House for the president's signing ceremony.
You know, it had a very familiar feel to it of when on February 14th, when I issued a declaration of disaster. So I think it's a positive thing that we're all in the field now.
Walker was the second governor in the country to declare a state-level disaster related to opioids. Supporters of the move say it helped save lives by putting thousands of units of the overdose-reversing drug naloxone into the hands of Alaskans and marshaled state resources to better confront addiction while curbing access to prescription pain pills. Walker says the federal declaration could unlock more funds for Alaska or provide greater flexibility in federal rules.
Much of what he has proposed is much of what we're doing in Alaska already, but to do it on a national basis has greater significance.
One of Alaska's authorities on the opioid crisis is Dr. Jay Butler, the state's chief medical officer, who was also in Washington for the day's events.
What we heard today was a very high-level overview, which I think was very positive. But there's two questions. What are some of the specifics that this will mean? And are there resources that are going to support some of the visionary ideals that we heard today?
Butler hopes the declaration will prompt a supplemental appropriation from Congress to bring more money into states for treatment and prevention efforts. One remark the president made that stood out to Butler was a reference to ending a rule known as the IMD exclusion, which bans Medicaid payments to treatment facilities that have more than 16 beds. In Alaska, that has been a major barrier. One member of the Anchorage Assembly, who's worked for the Aquila Recovery Center, says if it weren't for the IMD rule, they'd be able to double the number of beds at the facility. State officials have already asked for an exemption from the policy. After Trump's declaration, people working up close on substance abuse and recovery are optimistic.
No, it's a really, really big deal.
Carl Soderstrom is one of the founders of Fiend to Clean, a program in Wasilla that helps connect people with treatment and recovery. He constantly works with people who are trying to get clean but who don't have the money for private treatment options and can't get a spot in facilities that accept Medicaid.
The majority of Alaskans that are indigent, that are homeless, that are IV drug users, a lot of these folks meet the criteria for a residential treatment stay, but don't have access to one.
Soderstrom says the president's move opens the door for expanded treatment, and he hopes programs like his will see a trickle-down in funds if federal dollars follow. He thinks it's unfortunate the disaster declaration has taken so long, and points out that since the president first announced his intention of designating a federal emergency in August, thousands of Americans have died from opioid overdoses. Still, for Soderstrom, this drives the issue to the front of public consciousness.
I think it's great news. I think that President Trump was really smart to put the commission on substance abuse together. And I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. This disaster declaration pushes the opiate epidemic up as a priority. So now we have to do something about it.
Both of Alaska's senators applauded today's move and say they'll push for additional resources. The Coast Guard is working to remove fuel and other hazardous material from an abandoned fishing vessel in Unalaska's Captain's Bay. The Accutan arrived in August after a disastrous fishing season in Bristol Bay. Since then, more than half a dozen state and federal agencies have been keeping an eye on the vessel, but none are willing or able to remove it from the bay. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk reports city leaders are frustrated no one is taking responsibility for the derelict ship.
Fall in the Aleutians means strong winds, so strong they can cause a ship to drag anchor. That's exactly what happened on October 5th, when Unalaska Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin received a call that the fishing vessel Accutan was headed towards the beach.
It was roughly 200 yards off the beach. We were able to work with Dunlap Towing, and they went out and got a line on it, kept it off the beach, kept it from, you know, potentially breaching its hull.
That prompted the Coast Guard to take another look at the abandoned vessel. Officials determined the vessel was in imminent danger of polluting the bay. The Coast Guard has hired a salvage company to remove the remaining fuel and other hazardous substances from the Accutan. So far, Lieutenant Abby Lyon says Resolve Magone Marine has offloaded 14,000 gallons of fuel.
When it's not raining sideways and blowing 75 knots outside, they've been working on the Accutan to remove all the fuel.
With unpredictable weather, Lyons does not know when the cleanup will be completed, but she estimates there are at most 20,000 gallons left on the vessel.
As Resolve's going on board and going into some of the tanks, they're just finding, you know, that there's fuel and oily waste places that it wouldn't normally be or, you know, shouldn't be held.
So far, the Coast Guard has spent almost $2 million on the cleanup. McLaughlin, the port's director, is glad to see the fuel removal taking place, but says it doesn't solve the problem of having a large ship abandoned in a busy, ecologically important bay as winter sets in. Removing the heavy fuel will cause the Accutan to sit higher in the water, making it more susceptible to strong winds. Even with additional efforts to secure the boat, McLaughlin is concerned the ship may run aground or sink.
Captain's Bay in the wintertime can be absolutely crazy with winds, and we've seen it time and time again where anchorages don't hold.
Ultimately, McLaughlin would like to see the boat out of Unalaska waters, but there's no indication the Accutan will be moving anytime soon. After the Accutan's owners abandoned the vessel, the city was hopeful a state or federal agency would step in to remove it. But McLaughlin has found that unless there is immediate danger, like an environmental threat, there's not much that any party will do.
There's at least a half a dozen plus agencies involved with the Accutan in and of itself, and yet not one of those agencies has an opportunity or a mechanism to enact any kind of jurisdiction over dealing with the vessel itself. The Coast Guard can come in and remove some of the contaminants, but the vessel remains where it's at.
McLaughlin and community members were under the impression that once the crew abandoned ship, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources would declare the Accutan a derelict vessel and gain jurisdiction to take steps to move the ship before it sinks or runs aground. However, DNR's Clark Cox says that's not the state's responsibility. Even if it was, he says they don't have the money.
Our staffing and the funding resources are quite limited, and we don't have them for a large vessel in a remote location like this. We're oftentimes left just as incapable of dealing with these issues as local municipalities and other state agencies.
While DNR is often looked to take the lead because they own state tidelands and are responsible for waterways, Alaska statute does not specify who is responsible for taking over derelict vessels. With no one taking responsibility for this ship, it's unclear what will happen to the Accutan. The city is adamant that it needs to move, but for the foreseeable future, it will remain anchored and ghost-like in Captain's Bay. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
The U.S. House today passed the Senate's budget resolution, and with it, the seeds of legislation that could open the Arctic refuge to oil drilling. The resolution has no force of law, but it tells committees in the House and Senate to draw up a bill that includes tax cuts. It also instructs the Energy and Resources Committees to find at least $1 billion in savings or revenues. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the best way to fulfill that demand is by opening ANWR. She just announced a hearing on it November 2nd in the Senate Energy Committee, which she chairs. BP will likely plug and abandon 13 wells on the North Slope following an accident that happened earlier this year. That's according to Kathy Forster of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The commission met with BP representatives today for an update on the incident. This April, one of the company's older wells spewed oil and gas for several days before it could be plugged. Months later, BP determined 14 other wells were at risk, five of which were producing oil. Forster says it's likely all but one will be shut down for good. That's a small number compared to the roughly 1,800 wells at Prudhoe Bay. But still, state regulators are making sure BP shares its investigations with other oil companies.
Anybody that's got an old well on the North Slope needs to know what the results of their investigation are and look for implications in their fields.
BP thinks the accident was caused by thawing permafrost deep below the surface, which put uneven stress on the well. Eventually, the well gave out, rising several feet out of the ground and colliding with the top of the building over the well. BP hasn't been calling the incident a blowout. Forster says oil industry engineers wouldn't call it that because there wasn't a rig on top of the well. But she says it was definitely an uncontrolled leak.
If that's how you define it, then yeah, it was a blowout. If you define it in the black and white way that engineers tend to define things, no. So, you know, it's semantics. You call it what you want to call it. But what it was an uncontrolled release of hydrocarbons to the surface, and that's not a good thing.
That wasn't BP's only accident this year. Last week, BuzzFeed News released documents showing the company forced many workers to halt work for 12 days this month following a series of worker safety incidents. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Kenai group's mission to help convicts get on the right track after prison.
A lot of times, people coming out of incarceration, you open the gates and it's like opening the screen door for a two-year-old, because a lot of times people just know how to survive.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Lawmakers are proposing some changes to a bill aimed at revising the state's criminal sentencing laws. But these changes haven't dramatically altered the main provisions of the bill, or its cost. The House Judiciary Committee passed six amendments to Senate Bill 54. It voted down 17 others through mid-afternoon today. Anchorage Republican Chuck Kopp has proved to be a key vote on the amendments. The retired police officer has voted for some, but he's voted against most and largely stuck to the recommendations of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission included in the bill. One amendment that was defeated would have increased penalties for drug offenders. Kopp voted no, citing the fact that prosecutors had not asked for it. He says prosecutors' work is difficult.
You have no capacity to appreciate that it leaves scars on their soul protecting us. And so when they come here and tell us this is what we think is right, I defer to that. They suffered to get to the wisdom they have to tell us this. And it is to our peril that we ignore and we mock them.
The hearings have been testy. Eagle River Republican Representative Laura Reinbold questioned the testimony of John Skidmore, who directs the state's criminal prosecutions.
I recognize you're here on behalf of the Attorney General representing the Department of Law, not necessarily fighting for the prosecutors.
Skidmore took exception.
I need to correct that misrepresentation. I am sitting here fighting for prosecutors. I am sitting here trying to make sure that they get the right tools.
Skidmore says it will take more time for the department to make recommendations to change the law. Whether Senate Bill 54 becomes law may depend on how much it's amended. The more it's changed, the more difficult it may be for both legislative chambers to agree to a bill. And there has been some concern that amendments to the bill could increase spending. The bill is one of two items that Governor Bill Walker included in the special session that's scheduled to end by November 21st. The other bill would institute a 1.5% payroll tax. And in the year since Senate Bill 91 was signed into law, there has been plenty of debate over whether the criminal justice reform measure is working to reduce Alaska's prison population. As lawmakers decide in Juneau how to tweak the law, an organization is forming on the Kenai Peninsula in the hopes of reducing recidivism, as KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports.
When someone leaves the Kenai Peninsula's two state correctional facilities, they might be reentering the community without a support system. They might not even know what the first step in rebuilding their life is.
A lot of times, people coming out of incarceration, you open the gates and it's like opening the screen door for a two-year-old. You know, we don't really know what to do. Like, okay, what do I do now? Because a lot of times people just know how to survive.
Audrey Kakulia is the executive coordinator for the Kenai Reentry Coalition, which got its start a little over a year ago with about $150,000 in funding and help from about 20 agencies and organizations. The coalition is setting up shop in a Peninsula Community Health Services building in Kenai. The idea is for the coalition to be that first step outside of prison doors, a one-stop shop for anything someone might need to regain a foothold in their community. Jody Stewart is the probation liaison with the coalition and also works for the Department of Corrections.
Some people need help with employment. Others need help with getting just the basic things met, like food, shelter. Others just need an extra person to call when they don't know what to do next. So it depends on the person and the person's needs.
Both Kakulia and Stewart say there's a big need for these kind of services on the peninsula and around the state. About 70% of people leaving prison in Alaska will end up behind bars again. Other communities around the state have been working to reduce that number. Juneau, the Mat-Su, Fairbanks, and Anchorage all have reentry coalitions, but just how well are they doing? Devin Urquhart is the coalition coordinator in Anchorage. She says they're working on that answer. All four groups receive some funding from the state to hire case managers that meet with prisoners 3 months before they get out.
Each returning citizen has a plan that the case manager works with them on, make sure that they have housing and that they have their employment and that they're connected to the right treatment and wellness resources.
Each case manager can work with up to 40 clients and guides them through the nine-month program. The coalition started getting referrals from correctional facilities back in May. The state is tracking those clients through a database to see how many return to prison, essentially measuring the recidivism within the program. And that could mean measurable success for the coalitions to point to after the first round of clients complete the program in early 2018.
If this works and we're seeing the kinds of results that we need to see and that we want to see, it means everything to us. I mean, our communities are safer. People are connected to their families. We have healthy returning citizens.
Coalition partner Peninsula Community Health Services is working to hire four peer support professionals by the end of October. And the coalition hopes to open its doors officially in January. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
When it comes to keeping its air clean, the Matanuska Susitna Borough is looking north to Fairbanks. Smoke from wood burning in the Mat-Su Butte region is pushing ever closer to violating federal air quality standards. Too many bad air days, and the Environmental Protection Agency will swoop in to take action. That is what happened in Fairbanks, and it's cost millions to address. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
A combination of geography, cold temperature, and stagnant air can cause smoke from wood stoves or burn piles to get trapped close to the ground, and the particulates in the smoke are harmful to lungs. That health risk is why the EPA regulates air quality. Speaking to the Mat-Su Borough Assembly in Palmer this week, Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Carl Castle says Fairbanks has spent considerable time and money getting in line with EPA rules.
Their mission really has been to help us get to cleaner air. This is a health problem. We see upticks at our hospital when the air is bad, and they understand that coming in like a SWAT team is going to make people annoyed.
Fairbanks officials have tried to educate residents on the benefits of burning drier wood and cleaning their chimneys. They funded a program to swap old stoves for more efficient ones and developed guidelines for burn bans and fines for violators. But there has been some pushback in Fairbanks. On a few occasions, Fairbanks residents have voted to limit the borough's powers over regulating air quality. With similar smoke issues on the horizon in Butte, Mat-Su borough officials are concerned. Mat-Su borough manager John Moosey says he wants to not only avoid negative impacts to Valley residents' health, but also running afoul of the EPA.
And as we learned from Fairbanks,
The cost to try to reverse that and improve that is incredible.
Moosey says, like in Fairbanks, there are opportunities for education and person-to-person communication, like calling individual wood burners to discuss ongoing smoke problems. Moosey says one big push is getting people to properly split and stack firewood so that it dries out as much as possible. He also says there may be ways to better define the best times to burn brush, when it's not too hot, dry, and windy because of wildfire danger, and during colder times when an inversion layer can trap the smoke. But the question is, will it be difficult to convince people to get on board?
People live in Alaska because they like freedom, and we want to honor that. And we want people to be able to use their choice of heating their homes. And I think with doing some preventive measures, we're not going to have to worry about it. It's just going to take a little effort.
Meantime, the Mat-Su Borough issued an air quality alert Thursday for a different reason: wind-blown silt. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Members of the Unalaska City Council are under investigation. This week, the island's police chief confirmed that the Department of Public Safety is investigating current and potentially former city councilors. KUCB's Laura Craigle reports.
Police Chief Mike Holman declined to comment on the scope of the inquiry, but at a city council meeting Tuesday night, former councilor Udelka LeClaire connected it to the ongoing controversy surrounding Deputy Police Chief Jennifer Shockley.
I can stand here and look at you, Officer Shockley. We never gave an order to fire you.
Since August, the council has denied accusations that they pressured former city manager Dave Martinson to discipline Shockley for creating a survey asking Unalaskans to rate their satisfaction with each councilor. When Martinson resigned last month, however, he cited long-term tension with the council that came to a head recently over a personnel decision. While it appears councilors are now under investigation for their roles in that power struggle, Councilor Dave Gregory says the extent of the probe is unclear.
There's an investigation of council members. Maybe it's Roger, maybe it's me, maybe it was Udelka, maybe it's the other council members. We don't know, and we can't get any information on it.
Holman says the local public safety department is part of the investigation, but he wouldn't confirm whether other agencies are involved or comment on the timeline for completion. The most specific information came from Councillor Alejandro Bongtungal, who joined the meeting by phone. He says an attorney has asked to review his emails.
I'm being served a warrant on my computer, which I'm not happy about.
A KUCB public information request for all August emails between the city manager, mayor, and council was returned heavily redacted by the city attorney. While the community awaits more information, the council has narrowly upheld a directive that could launch a counter-investigation. At her last meeting in office, LeClaire proposed hiring a third-party investigator to look into the matter. Several current councilors argued the city should let the ongoing inquiry play out before taking any further action, but others, including James Fitch, agreed that an independent investigator is necessary, given the deputy police chief's role in the incident.
Since people who are in the public safety division are kind of part of this, then we need to get some outside assistance with this.
Councilors split over the directive 3-3, leaving Mayor Frank Kelty to cast the tiebreaker vote. He pushed the motion forward, authorizing the interim city manager and city attorney to explore the possibility of contracting for a separate investigation. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
Holding the attention of future scientists and engineers can be tricky. So in Juneau, a group of STEM advocates, that's science, technology, and engineering and math, are working on a database to make it easy for teachers and students to connect professionals who work in those fields every day. KTOO's Adeline Baxter reports.
For a town of its size, Juneau has an impressive number of professionals with scientific backgrounds. Jordan Watson is a fisheries scientist at NOAA.
From mining expertise and engineering, kind of geology, we have the glacial, we have University of Alaska Southeast, University of Alaska Fairbanks has fisheries here, we have NOAA fisheries, we have all the state organizations. We have so many different expertise here, and in such a small town, it would seem a shame to not be using it in the classrooms.
He and other members of Southeast Exchange, or C, wanted to find a way to bring all those resources to teachers. They hosted a networking event recently to help bridge that gap. About 150 educators and STEM professionals came to network and register in C's directory. The goal is to create a database where teachers can search a topic like glaciers or bridge building and immediately find contact info for someone local with expertise in that field. For science and math educators, the opportunity to bring a professional into the classroom is not just a respite from the daily grind of teaching. Carol May used to be an engineer, but found herself drawn to education. Now, she's a statistics and computer science teacher at Thunder Mountain High School.
I can tell the kids, yeah, when I was an engineer, I did this, but that was a long time ago. It doesn't have the same credibility as somebody who's actually doing it day to day.
Thunder Mountain High School already hosts one very successful STEM collaboration. About 8 years ago, UAF professor Shannon Atkinson approached the school administration about creating a partnership between the campus and the school. It led to juniors and seniors re-articulating a marine mammal skeleton in class each semester. They learn about anatomy, ecology, and environmental stewardship along the way. TMHS marine sciences teacher Kristen Wells said somewhere between 300 and 400 students have taken the class to date, earning both high school and college credit.
Well, it's a beautiful pairing that they get to actually work on a marine mammal that there is marine policies that don't allow us that access, so it's incredible that we get that access through this partnership, and the kids really value that.
By the end of the networking event, 80 teachers and 63 community members had registered in C's directory, paving the way for more dissections and skeletal articulations to come. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer tonight is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. Casey Grove and Annie Fite produced tonight's show. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Juneau, October 31st through November 2nd, at Elizabeth Peratrovich Hall from 8:30 to 5. To discuss proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.